everybody, and welcome to the History and Technicolor. This is me, David, and...
This is Wolf.
Excellent. So, today it's mine. It's all about me, Wolf, and we're going to do Lion in Winter. But before we do the Lion in Winter...
Yes?
You're looking at me as though you're surprised.
I feel like you're going to throw something out at me that I wasn't expecting.
Could be. Not another song? Obviously. Not another song. There's too many songs. So, Outlaw King.
Yes.
It came up. I got hounded by quite a few people, actually, saying, oh, you've got to do Outlaw King. It's really, really good. So in a moment of weakness, I said, okay, I will do Outlaw King. And then I talked to you and you said, no. So I said, oh, all right. But I did watch it. Secretly, I snuck away and I did watch it.
Yes.
I'm sorry about that. And I thought we should just very quickly say, and we had a little snap poll on the Facebook site.
Yep.
And the answer was that 77% of people said, it's all right.
Yep. It's all right.
Yeah. Which is a bit tragic. Basically, I thought it was fine. You know, the nice thing about it was that it was nice and accurate. But it sort of lacked a bit of pizzazz, really, didn't it?
What would you rank it in accuracy?
In accuracy, it's probably a 7.
Okay.
You know, they still messed around quite a lot. They had to really probably... But, you know, it was reasonably good. They had a civil war. They were dressed in the right way. They didn't wear anything stupid on their face. But the biggest problem with the movie, of course, is the haircut. They gave Chris Pine a mullet. I mean, I thought the mullet had been banned for all time. You know, the 70s were a nightmare of a decade, Wolf. We had mullets.
My favourite thing is trying to spot mullets in the modern world.
No, nobody's got mullets in the modern world.
I've seen a few.
Never.
Don't worry. Every time I see one, I notice.
Well, a nightmare. Anyway,
Mitchell
it was
Guide
fine.
To Mullets.
It was good, quite fun, enjoyed it, but, you know, it didn't really get you excited.
I think what's really interesting and is important because of how much we complained about Braveheart.
Indeed.
The Outlaw King is more accurate, but it's significantly less entertaining than Braveheart.
Well, on the other hand, just going back to my algorithm, which I need to obviously develop, it was also considerably less irritating than Braveheart. So although I might was in danger of throwing something at the telly with Braveheart, I felt in no danger of doing that with the Outlaw
King. I do understand that, but at least in defence of Braveheart, I kind of care whether I'm angry or involved. It draws something out of me, and I feel at least engaged by the film. Whereas The Outlaw King, I was quite bored.
You'd have to take a blowtorch to me to admit that Braveheart was in any way a better movie than Outlaw King.
What score would you give the film The Outlaw King?
6.1.
And is this because you gave Braveheart 6?
Might be.
Okay. Well,
okay.
We've established you're a liar and a cheat.
Phew, the nicest thing you've ever said about me. Right, so we're going to talk about The Lion King. No, we're not. That would be interesting. We're going to talk about The Lion in Winter.
Yes,
so,
Lion in Winter.
Why did I choose The Lion in Winter? A refined form of sadomasochism, essentially, Wolf. I have seen this before when I was alive.
You didn't see this when you were dead?
No.
You saw this when you were alive? Okay.
Yeah, which is a long time
ago.
Just
so we know where we are in your life.
Uh-huh. I remember Katharine Hepburn wearing the worst article of clothing I have ever seen anybody wear. And, you know, and that is quite a statement since we've just talked about mullets.
Plus, I've seen your trousers.
That's very rude. I remember it to have been a commercial success, so I thought to myself, but also I remembered it to be as dull as ditch water. Literally as dull as ditch water. I thought, this is the dullest thing I'm being made to watch. Why am I watching this? So I was interested. Here's an opportunity, I thought, to go back and see, could this thing that was so dull really have been a commercial success? Could it have been so bad? Could poor old Catherine really have been made to wear that article of clothing? Okay.
Okay.
So that's why.
I'm interested to see what you think.
These are good, shallow reasons, aren't they? Also, there's another reason, which we're doing Eleanor of Aquitaine on the members' shedcast at the moment. And this, of course, fits into her life. So I thought, let's see what it tells us about her and her sons and her husband.
And let's not forget, we did a poll before we launched our first episode.
That is a very good point.
And this was the film that came up the most often by the most people.
Except for
The Man for All Seasons.
A Man for All Seasons, which you hated. So
I thought this came out on top.
You might be right.
I believe you told me this came out on top.
A Man for All Seasons for Second.
A Man for All Seasons for Second, which might be what I argue is actually based on the quality of the film.
Okay. So you might... So I'm gonna hold up. I'm going to ask you what you think in just a moment. So what was it? It was a play originally, would you believe?
So you must have loved it,
yeah,
David.
Yeah, on Broadway. Actually, the play
Since
crashed and burned.
Since theatre is better than film.
It is, as you say. The play crashed and burned, though. So they thought, let's make a film of that then, which is an odd decision. Anyway, they did. It's written by James Goldman, director Anthony Harvey, for which this was one of his earliest movies, and also the only one that was essentially any cop. I exaggerate for effect, but he had his career peaked early. got 7 Oscar nominations and it won 3 of them. Katharine Hepburn won for Best Actress. Best Music Score win for John Barry, who I'd never heard of. But when I said Lana Winter, Jane said, oh, that'd be John Barry, won't it? He's really good.
John Barry's amazing.
Is he?
Did you not look up all the work that he'd done?
No.
He's done almost every James Bond movie.
Ah, that's right. That's what Jane said. Yeah, okay.
He also did Dances with Wolves.
Did he do... do 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 do
I don't know. He did The Ipcress File.
That's a great movie.
He did Dances with Wolves.
Probably not, can it? Dances with Wolves.
Loads.
Okay. Anyway, so the film relates a Christmas court. Oh, incidentally, they tried remaking this film in 2003 in a TV thing with Patrick Stewart and Glenn Close, which is kind of, you know, fine. But why would he do that? I've never understood the remake thing. Mary Poppins, why are they remaking Mary Poppins?
It's not a remake.
Isn't it?
No, Mary Poppins is a sequel.
Ah, right.
The two children have grown up now.
Have they?
Yeah.
Is that right? Well, who wants to watch grown-ups?
Because they have a family as well. Mary Poppins has to return to help them. Right. It makes perfect sense. It
makes no sense at all. It's going to take a blowtorch for me to get me to that film. No, I probably will go and say it. Anyway, the film relates a Christmas court where Henry II and his family get together, supposedly in 1183. So here's the thing. Here's what happens. Henry II was the Count of Anjou, made good. He becomes King of England by right after the anarchy, and then he marries Eleanor of Aquitaine. Eleanor of Aquitaine is the richest, the most... he's got vast tracts of land. Ex-wife of Louis, King of France, managed to divorce from Louis, which is astounding. You know, why did Louis do it? Because France was a little tiny little thing at that stage. The Ile de France, that's all it is. Anyway, so she's this massive heiress. They have a load of children. And the children all need, generally, the whole household needs an Asbo because, you know, they're outrageous. There's a tradition, there's a myth about the Angevins that one of their ancestors was this devil called Melusine who flies out the church window. And Richard, very famously, apparently says at one stage, rather proudly, Richard the Lionheart, that is, from the devil we came, to the devil we will go. So he's rather proud about the fact that they are a bunch of misfits. Henry can't work out, he's got his big, massive empire, which is most of Western France plus England. Can't work out what to do with it. In those days, there's no national story here. This is a big lord who happens to have loads of individual bits of land. There is no reason it should stay together. And in the film, one of the inaccuracies actually is that it says, I want to keep my Anjou and empire together. He doesn't necessarily. He wants to make sure it gets handed over in the right way. But he's not a good delegator. So he gives his eldest son, Henry the Young King, who's died by the time of this actually, he gives him the title of king and then gives him no money, gives him no power. So all of these lads, they're livid. They want political power. And in 1173, 10 years before this takes place, they all revolt. And Eleanor, the king's wife, helps that revolt and is part of it as Duchess of Aquitaine, this vast, massive bit of his realm. And that, the whole world, Christendom, is appalled. You know, women don't do that. Women do what they're told. They're obedient, they sew tapestries, they act as an intercessor of mercy between the king and his people, they create beautiful tapestries, they endow...
Sounds like they created a lot of tapestries.
A lot of tapestries. Did I mention tapestries? I did. They give money to the monasteries, they endow the church, they have a role, a very important role, blah, 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 but it's not political.
Okay.
By this stage. Eleanor fights back, she's a player. So, they lose in 73. Henry always wins, or it is until the right, the last moment, this is 10 years later. Plus, they have Philip II. Philip II is the son of Louis, Eleanor's supposed wife, and he will be the Angevin nemesis. He will rob John of most of the land except for Gascony. Okay, so that's the story. And they all get together. This is a Christmas court, and they're all arguing about who gets what. And they're all intriguing and making all these plans, and Peter O'Toole is doing his stuff. So Peter O'Toole is Henry II. So... there's a setup. What did you think of it?
Okay. Well, to start with, it should be clear, you had set me up to absolutely hate this film.
I fully expected you wouldn't. As I watched it, I was thinking, oh my God, Wolf is going to hate this. Oh, no. Oh,
You told me how much you disliked it. And because you compared it so much to A Man for All Seasons, you're essentially like, well, if you didn't enjoy Man Four Seasons that much, then you're definitely not going to enjoy this at all.
Yeah.
And when it opened with still images of these stone gargoyles just in like the church. And I was like, it's identical. And the only saving grace was the music was really good. So the music in the opening was really good. And I was like, this score is great.
Okay.
And then I looked up as John Barry. I was like, okay, brilliant. Makes sense.
John who? Okay, keep going. Sorry, joke.
And I realised that at first I was like, this is going to be a slog. But I quickly grasped what I thought the film was about. And once I'd realised what it was doing, I thought it was a hoot.
What was the film about?
That it was a tongue-in-cheek comedy.
Interesting. Interesting.
I really enjoyed, we're going to talk about a lot of these, I really enjoyed the Shakespearean connections. I really enjoyed the kind of modern interpretation of history. I really quite enjoyed the fact that I could tell it was a play, but it was just really...
But you hated that. When it was A Man for All Seasons, you hated that.
Yeah, but this is completely different. It chooses to approach the subject from a completely different angle. And I just thought it was really rewarding and really fun.
Good Lord. Well, I'm a stand-up. I'm going to read a quote to you, okay, which I'm then going to completely disagree with. We believe in the complicated intrigue these people get themselves into because we believe in them. They look real, inhabit a world that looks lived in. I couldn't disagree with that statement more. You always know, or I think you always know, that you're in a play, which just happens to have a camera pointing in it. They've clearly... We'll come to the historical accuracy. I'm not saying that's terrible, actually. But if you think A Man for All Seasons is antiquated, is a play, you know, on film, then this absolutely is. Nothing happens physically. I'm going to give you another quote. There are no waves, no wrecks, nobody gets drowned. There's nothing to laugh at all. Do you know who that is?
No, but you've done an accent, so it's someone who has an accent.
I didn't do a very accurate accent.
Okay, well, you did one at the end.
It's Stanley Holloway. Do you know Stanley Holloway is?
No, I don't, I'm afraid.
Oh, we've got so many happy hours ahead of us. Anyway, they just talk. You know, it's all about talking. It's all about
coming from someone who likes the theatre so much, I'm surprised you have a problem with talking.
It's just that on the negative side, but that's not the point, really, because I didn't end up hating the play, actually. That's not the point. The point is that it doesn't pretend to be real, I don't think. I mean, it tries to be, you know, reasonably accurate so it doesn't hit you in the face. But it's not about, it's not trying to be realistic. This is an imagined event.
Yep.
The event in 1183 never happened, but similar events did happen. All the characters are real. This is somebody, you're absolutely right, having a bit of fun. Saying, these are fascinating characters. We're going to play around with how this might have looked here. And I suspect this is a play which is a lot more fun, like a Monty Python sketch. You know those old Monty Python sketches on telly, don't you? You've ever seen them, you're too young, aren't you? But 99.9% of the Monty Python sketch are really rubbish when you see them on the telly. 80% of them are actually rubbish.
No, they're not.
Oh, they seriously are. Oh, come on. The thing about Monty Python is they get better every time you tell them. And amongst the pile of dung, there is 20% of absolute
I would say it's a little
gold.
Bit higher than 20%. Let's,
fine, we can argue about the percentage.
The Olympic hide-and-seek competition.
But it's only funny because you're talking about it. It's like, is Vic there? You remember that one? Is Vic there? No, I'm afraid. Nick Vic's there. And anyway, very funny in talking about it. I'm rubbish at the time. At the time, I'm thinking, I'm going to make myself a cup of tea now. Anyway, I have a feeling it's like that. The more you think about it, the more you talk about it, the more you pick it over, the funnier you realise it is. So there's one stage where... So it's the language. The film loves the language. The whole way through, there are all these little gags and little jokes. So at one stage, Peter O'Toole is yelling at Catherine and she's on a bit of a downer because they go up, they go down, they go in, they go out. And
then they do the hokey-cokey?
They do, actually. I mean, several times. And he says, I'm vilifying you. Pay attention. It's a nice line. And they go through all this chaos and madness, you know, and then at the end of it, or near the end, Eleanor says something, says, oh, well, which family doesn't have its ups and downs? You know, and they're killing each other and they've been murdering each other for decades. And, you know, she dismisses it. Everyone ignores Geoffrey and he says, you're all ignoring me. So they ignore him a little bit more. It's funny.
It's really funny. I think it's...
Really funny is big. It's quite cerebrally funny, isn't it?
Yes, but Katharine Hepburn has 3 absolute zingers per minute for the entire movie.
Go on then. Can you remember any?
They never stop. So John, who's obviously been set up, two things. John is the worst actor I've ever seen.
Ever seen. They must have picked him. So he's really rubbish acting, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay, his costume is terrible. Yes. The bit where they say he has pimples, and in the very next shot, he has these terribly like stuck-on spots. He is absolutely atrocious. And his constant screaming about daddy is just so like weird. But daddy, you promised me.
I mean, it's clearly rubbish.
It's like I'm watching Kevin and Perry.
Yeah.
But just for his one character, the rest of it is a completely different movie.
Yeah.
Okay, John just sticks out like a sore thumb.
It does.
Anyway, he's set up as being stinky and disgusting. So Eleanor arrives and she's like, John, you're so clean and neat. And then later on she says, I never cease to marvel at the quickness of your mind, John, knowing that he's an absolute buffoon and he doesn't even understand.
This is her son. She's
It's just so smart. Like the bit where they're all manipulating each other and she brings up Henry's love who's died. I can't remember what her name was.
Rosamond.
And she then says, it's been so many days since she died. And he's like, you counted the days?
Yeah.
And then she's like, I made them up.
Yeah.
She's just like...
Very sharp.
She's just playing with him. The whole time, there are all these barbs and they're just constantly coming out at everybody. The line where she says, he's got a knife, we've all got knives. It's 1183 and we're barbarians.
That's a lovely thing, actually. That leads into another key bit, which is that this is a film consciously sending itself up. So at one stage, Eleanor says, oh, that's the problem with prehistory. They had no documentation there. This is a play which is consciously saying, we don't know what went on. We're going to have a bit of fun with the history here. And, you know, it's very self-referential. It's very self-aware that what it's doing is having a bit of a hoot.
So I think what's brilliant about this is that the plot is essentially King Lear.
Oh, is it? I suppose it is. Yes, it's the king being stabbed to death. Although...
No, what I mean is the king trying to decide which of his children should get his...
But he's much more Machiavellian.
Agree, but I just mean in a general principle. Also, the fact that he loves the youngest one the most.
Yeah.
And then all the others conspire and everybody's fighting amongst themselves.
Well, but John isn't very Cordelia-like, is he?
No. But still, my point being is that it's a classic story. Like a really interesting... You can tell why they picked it because it's such a great moment in history. Yeah. That the king's got to try and work out which of his children... Because normally they just give it to the next one. Like, it follows in, like, a rule.
Yes, and it's... There is... Well, we'll come to the accuracy, but there is an accurate bit about that. Henry does cause a lot of problem by trying to give John some land. John is known as Lackland. He's much younger than most of the others. So, actually, he does cause a lot of problem by trying to
give because it should just be Richard. There shouldn't even be a discussion about it. So the fact that all of this is happening is really interesting. So I think it's a great structure to have. And then
I'm going to argue that a little bit. Okay. But we'll argue about that later.
I just love that they sat down and they were like, they must have been having the discussion, but like, what could have happened? How do we resolve this? Let's make a Christmas movie, a family Christmas movie, which every family Christmas movie is about all these people coming together, maybe for the first once a year, and all of their like lingering hatreds and
our Christmas
arguing.
Is nothing like this.
No, but you know what I mean?
Although, actually, yes.
Every Christmas movie you've ever seen, I mean, anyone you can possibly think of, it's where everybody resolves their issues or it starts off really pleasant and then it breaks down into absolute chaos and then maybe there's a little bit of learning at the end. But it's usually all these little nitpicky things going on and they're tricking each other and, you know, there'll be the new wife or something who makes the much better dessert.
That's true.
And
I never thought of that.
It's happening all the time. And in this film, obviously, Alice is there. And then Eleanor's constantly like having these barbs with Alice. And she's also really hurt by her presence. Mm. All the three brothers are squabbling with each other. You've got Philip there. And they're all trapped in this castle. And they're like, what would you do if you trap them all and then make them try and resolve this?
Yeah.
There's
lots of devices, aren't there? So the bit with the tapestries
is
great, wasn't it? It was very prosper. Who is the guy who gets killed behind the nut? There's one in Hamlet. Anyway,
Polonius.
It's very classical, isn't it? They keep coming in. They keep putting other people behind the tapestry until everybody's behind the tapestries, and then
they each keep revealing each other.
Come out, yeah, and
The dramatic effect is great.
And actually, funny enough, in that, that's one of the very few scenes which actually had some emotional force. Because generally, the thing that got me about the play was that I didn't really care, actually. You know, this was a mask being played in front of me, a dance. The dance was what was important, not the players, almost. But there's one, this scene has some emotional force because it's the scene where you have Richard declaring himself as a homosexual and being, you know, very brutally rejected by Philip. And it's the scene where you see Philip getting, you see his, because he's
it's the
much
best,
more talented.
It's the best bit of the film, the whole construction of it.
Yeah.
That they have this plan and then, is it Joffrey? Jeffrey heads there. And when he gets there, John's already there conspiring against him. Jeffrey is now conspiring against the others. So they have their argument. And then there's a knock on the door. So they get put behind the tapestry. And then Richard comes in. And then he's conspiring against them. And every time Philip lies to each of them, even though each of them can hear behind the tapestries, then Richard gets hidden. And then the king turns up. I'm laughing. This is brilliant. I'm like, there's a knock on the door. It's the king. Yeah. Oh, great. I actually thought it could be Eleanor. But Henry comes in. And you know that they're all listening, so you've got that kind of dramatic tension.
Yeah.
And then they each reveal themselves back the opposite way. They keep unravelling the present. They've wrapped it up, now they unravel it.
Yeah, true.
And then the dramatic, the moment at the end when he's like, they've all just been quabbling, but it's like normal. And then they pull back the curtain and reveals John's also betrayed him. The one son he couldn't believe
would ever do
that.
Yeah.
And it completely breaks him. So you get actually loads of really significant character development occur within that scene, with the comedy, it all just plays out really well, and you know, it works really well like on the screen as well. And I imagine it would do on stage.
Though the play bombed. The trouble with it all for me is because it's so convoluted, and you keep on getting these new. Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
That I've lost interest.
Yes.
Actually, in as I say, what I'm watching is a dance, and the intricate nature of the dance is quite fascinating. And but in actual fact, I don't care because I never believe these people are real. So it doesn't have much emotional force. It's just a little bit with Richard and Philip, as I just mentioned. And as you say, that for once, Henry appears to show some genuine emotion.
There's also quite a lot of really... Henry and Eleanor is still the best stuff.
Do you know, I know what you mean.
Oh, come on, David.
But again, you don't know, there's no point of reference. I don't know. I'm too simple a man, obviously. There's no point of reference in me thinking, okay, so what's the truth here? Because they're so much slidey aroundy and changing their story all the time. I don't actually know what the reality is.
Okay, so have you seen or read Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes, I was going to make
it's exactly
that comparison.
Like
it is exactly that. It is Who's
and
Afraid of Virginia
in
Woolf.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you're obviously...
Well, I watched it with Dickie Burton and Liz Taylor.
Yeah, and I think that O'Toole and Hepburn are like Taylor
they
versus Burton. Exactly like it.
Yes, it's the absolute perfect analogy. But in there, they are trying... You can see there's a... Well, no, it is exactly very similar.
You have to piece together their relationship.
Yes.
And you can't quite work out what's happened to them and why they... You just start at this party and you know they kind of hate each other and it gets worse and worse and worse.
Mm.
But at the same time, they know they're kind of perfect for each other.
Yeah.
And I think what you get a lot in this film is how great is the scene where they're walking down the hall and they're waving.
Yes.
And they're waving to everyone and they're like, I'm going to kill you through their, like, pursed lips. And they're just... They're just burning each other one after the other with zinger after zinger.
Yeah.
All these great lines. And they really, they know each other inside and out, so they can stab at each other's absolute weakest points. And the...
See, I don't like that very much.
And they keep manipulating each other. Like, don't you love the bit when Eleanor, like, breaks down loads and then,
nice
and then Eleanor's like, yes, I'll sign it for my freedom. And you know Henry thinks he's got one up on her.
Yeah.
And then... The tears have just managed to come away from her face by the time she sits down with the pen and she's like, on one condition.
Yeah.
Alice and Richard get married right now. And then you know that he doesn't want to do it, but he's such a stubborn man that, and he's so overwhelmed that he's like, yes, we're going to marry. And then they're storming through the castle, trying to wake everybody up and organise this marriage on the spot. It's hilarious.
Right, okay, good.
It's really interesting. And, okay, so throw this out there. Katharine Hepburn is absolutely perfect.
Right.
Okay, so she's built her career on making loads of really, really good screwball comedies.
Right.
Bringing Up Baby versus Cary Grant.
Right.
Philadelphia Story with him again. Then she did a whole series of films with her husband, Spencer Tracy. So there's Adam's Rib, for example, where they both play lawyers. One the defendant, one the accuser, on both sides. So they're always, like, quarrelling with really, like, smart, witty dialogue delivered really quickly. And she's just chewing the scenery up. It's like she's having such a good time. Just absolutely thrashing everybody around all the time and being really overly dramatic. And it's great.
They are. I mean, they really go for the over-dramatic thing. Peter O'Toole, I mean, he's... You could not imagine a more hammy actor. I suppose that's the thing. You see them acting. You know you are watching actors do their thing.
I think that's why I just see it as a really... slightly absurd, but really funny comedy. Yeah.
I think you've got to look at it through that lens. And the thing is, when I was little, I didn't look at anything through that lens, and I find it a bit difficult now. Once you know that's the lens you're looking at this through, the whole thing is transformed.
Yeah. When I thought it was a serious drama,
yeah,
it was really hammy and the acting was over the top and I couldn't follow it.
Yeah.
And I was really disinterested. Once Katharine Hepburn arrived and I realised, wait, everything she's saying is really funny.
Yeah.
History movies aren't that funny.
Yeah.
She's really funny. The more that kept happening, then I realised, okay, if I think about this as a Katharine Hepburn comedy movie, then now I kind of understand where I am.
Right.
And then from then on, it was...
You're going to enjoy it a bit more.
Yeah, it was really fun. Obviously, it's a little bit like a Raymond Chandler novel where the plot doesn't make any sense.
No.
It's The Big Sleep. Who did the murder? We don't know. We don't care.
Yeah, we don't. And the end of it, it's nothing is resolved.
And everybody's deceiving everybody. Yeah. And because it never happened, there can be no real outcome at the end.
Yeah.
So... it just kind of carries on, which, you know, the ending's a little bit weak, I guess.
Yes, they say, well, they basically say, we'll see you next year, sort of thing. And it looks like she leaves as though she's had a great time.
But, I think it's just really, really fun. And
great. Yeah.
I love seeing the royals reduced to petulant, quarrelling children.
Yeah.
I love that they've... because there's a really incredible moment where Henry says, I will be remembered better than I lived.
Right.
Okay, so Henry's broken down and he basically says, I'm going to be remembered like Quatermain. And he lists off all these people, Alexander the Great, etc. He's talking about all the greatest men who've like ever lived and everything they achieved. And he's going to be like, I'm going to be remembered like them, but I will not have been fun living my life.
Mm. Yes.
I'll be remembered for something that I never experienced.
Well, actually, it's quite accurate in a way. I mean, we remember Henry II as... This amazing ruler who transformed the legal system in England and gave us this common law, or started the process towards creating common law. That's how we remember him. We remember him also as the husband of Eleanor and something of his politics. But until you see this, you can't visualise just how potentially vicious and childish it was.
So how fascinating is it that you take this figure who's so kind of grand and great in everything they've achieved... and then you reduce them all to these like
squabbling children.
Just a bickering family at Christmas.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's a really fun kind of takedown of that. Rather than Man for All Seasons, for example, it's really trying to elevate everybody to reinforce their godlike status.
Yeah.
If anything, it kind of tries to support Henry, make him slightly better in our memory, and raises Thomas.
Yes, it's a hagiography of Thomas More, basically. Yeah.
It's. This is considering what's this? It's almost the same year that they come out, ish.
It's quite close, isn't it? 66. This wasn't it.
This is 68.
Yeah. So I think they might be the same year.
But it's a complete like counter idea to like how you would look at history and review it.
True.
And we love what ifs, and I just think it's a really interesting and fun what if that kind of builds around these characters.
Great. I'm a bit surprised, I must admit. But this is very gratifying. In fact, it sounds as though you like it more than I do. I thought Timothy Dalton was the pick of the bunch. But then maybe I think he was in a different play. Because he seemed to be properly acting as though he was Philip Augustus. And he was the only one I actually believed. I thought he was really good, but I did wonder if he walked onto the wrong set.
He's interesting. I think he's really good. He kind of comes a villain almost.
Well, he is the guy who will unwrap the Angevin Empire. He will do what is required. He has a purpose. He has a real purpose, whereas the others are just squabbling for power. He's got a plan.
And I do think there's enough going on in this story that some of the really personal reveals that Eleanor makes to herself in the mirror, or Henry does when he almost does this soliloquy, and everybody else. I think it's really interesting that there is kind of this stuff going on underneath it all. So we've got all this fighting, but there is some really interesting kind of looks at history that's like still happening in there, and the kind of almost meta analysis of the time, with the characters kind of are aware of their presence in history.
Well, that's the interesting thing, as we were saying earlier, that it's so self-referential, the comment about Eleanor saying, this is 1183 and we're all barbarians. It takes you outside of the play for a moment, doesn't it? Because it breaks that wall or whatever you call it. And suddenly you're looking in and realise that they're looking in.
So a few questions I did want to ask. How did you feel about the use of everybody's normal accents?
Well, I never even remarked on it, because it would be so confusing if you tried to get... Because they didn't speak modern French then anyway. You know, it would have been a mess.
That's fine. I just wanted to check that, obviously, when Henry is very English and is speaking to the very English Timothy Dalton, who's French, that you were fine with that. I just thought I would just check. Because I think it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would just get in the way horribly. Good. There was one thing I thought was quite interesting. You know when they go down, Eleanor is escaping, and they go down... I think it's Richard with them, or she's got a guard, and he kills the other guard.
Yeah.
In the middle of this fun, this froth and all the rest of it, you've got quite a vicious killing. Do you know the way they do it? That they struggle. You actually see the sword going in. You know, it's very naturalised. You see the leg kicking. That was a very odd bit, I thought.
Yeah.
You're suddenly in this, again, a completely different film, which is very... It was almost like that bit in... Saving Private Ryan, you know, where you get the death scene where he forces the knife very slowly towards and you see it slowly going in, you realise actually killing somebody is actually, you know, it was just a bit odd, that was all.
Yes, and for me, the emotional payoff or issue that occurs in the scene where kind of Richard reveals his love, it almost sticks out from the film because it doesn't really match the rest of the tone.
Yes, suddenly it's getting serious. So that's... I mean, I wondered whether that was conscious or just slightly maladroit, in the sense that suddenly does it remind you that, in actual fact, these people did cause war. They did kill lots of people in their efforts to win their bit of power. You know, there is a reality behind this bit of fun, which is a mayhem.
I think it's really interesting, the scene where Eleanor's like, she's like, are you going to have me, like... burned at the stake? Are you going to have me, like, hung, drawn, and quartered? She's, like, talking about all these different ways that he could kill her if he wanted to. And we can't forget that she's in prison.
She has been, like, in prison and will be in prison for another 5 years.
And she doesn't want to be in prison. She absolutely hates being in prison.
Indeed. She did rebel against her king.
Sure.
You know.
But I think there is still a few... I like to put a few reminders in there to let us know that these people are capable of terrible
indeed,
things.
Yeah, there's a bit of reality underneath.
And they really do all threaten to murder each other. And because they're never really going to go through with it, I think maybe it does remind us that there are, like, consequences. Yeah. And I really wasn't sure if Henry was going to strike down Richard towards the end.
Yeah.
The scene was, you know, quite powerful and impressive.
Great. Okay, so surprising enough you liked it. As a historical record, we can be pretty quick on this. The event shown, as we said, didn't take place. Chinon, though, of course, was the centre of Henry II's power. The film basically puts together a couple of things. So Henry meets with his sons at Angers earlier that year, and he has a summit meeting with Philip II at the great elm at Gisors, which Philip actually cuts down, which is where the kings of France and the kings of England used to meet on the border of Normandy. And it reflects the importance of the Christmas court. Of course, what you see is a very Victorian Christmas with a Christmas tree, for crying out loud. So, you know, there are inaccuracies all around it, and it is a story, quite clearly a story. So essentially what you see is they're kind of... It's a little like Master and Commander, but in Master and Commander, the historical accuracy is the god in terms of the environment. Here, they want to make it look reasonably realistic, and they very consciously make it earthy.
Yeah.
You know, they... Because what we're seeing is a squabble, as you're saying, a family squabble. That's all reinforced, I think, by the way they represent the period, which is perfectly realistic, but underground. So the court, this is the most glorious court in Christendom. What you're seeing is something that looks like, you know, a minor lord on some outskirts somewhere. They would have been covered with colour, covered with music, the greatest people in the land. You know, this is the greatest court in Christendom. So it's really not, even the framework isn't particularly accurate.
Okay. How about the relationship between Richard and Philip?
Yes. So this has always been one of the debates about Richard the Lionheart, whether he was gay or not. there's a report in, I think it's a Poitevin Chronicle, which talks about the king, French king loved him so much that he allowed him to share his bed. Now, people slept in the same bed very often because bed was quite a rare, not a rare thing, but it was quite an expensive piece of kit. So some people say, you know, this is rubbish. Actually, it's Roger of Hoveden, the chronicler. At night, their beds did not separate them. So, you know, your traditional people have said, oh, this is just people share beds all the time. Other people say, look, the way that's phrased, that night their bed did not separate them, is telling you something. He has a very unhappy relationship with poor old Berengaria, his wife of Berengaria of Navarre. Cheats her very badly, shows no interest, he has no children. You know, we're never going to know, but there's at least a strong possibility.
So it's a plausible interpretation?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's entirely possible to hold up an argument that Richard was gay, and that whether he had a relationship with, and had a relationship with Philip. So the inaccuracies, to sum up, the inaccuracies are legion. The accuracies are quite superficial. But they don't care.
No.
You know, I don't think. So there's a lovely bit, I thought, in the thing where you've got John snivelling away, and in the background there's a whole pen of pigs. You know, they're making the framework act to deliver the play rather than trying to reflect an event in an accurate framework. So I put it quite low in terms of accuracies. There are lots of accuracies, but, you know.
Yeah. I think, in fairness, when the characters enter, they kind of come in. There is quite a lot of detail about who they are. Like, I love the line, and then you can go and visit Richard wherever he is off killing people.
Yes.
The idea that they know that Richard's just off around the world.
They turn him into a murdering. They make him brutish, actually.
Yep.
There's a bit at the beginning where in a joust is a game. You're not meant to kill the other people. In fact, nobles in those days did not kill each other. So there's the joust at the beginning, and you see Richard almost about to kill this chap. It would never happen.
I think it's meant to parallel the scene later with Henry, but I'm not quite sure.
Yes, I think you're right. It's meant to show this guy was going to break the rules. He's just a brute. So, great. So let's mark it. Should we get historical accuracy out of the way? I would go for sort of 4 or 5 as far as historical accuracy is concerned. Bit harsh, should we go for 5?
No, I would go lower.
Right.
Only because every single event in the movie is consciously made up.
Yeah.
Completely made up. There's references to real history in like a wider scale, and they must know who the characters are in order to bring them into this world. But it's like, pick 5 random famous people. What if they all met? What kind of stuff might they say?
And the framework, they haven't done what they've done in Master and Commander, say, try and make the framework beautifully accurate.
It's like a comedy. So there might be, some of these people might not have actually conspired against each other, like really that much in real life.
I think they did.
But
not in that way necessarily, but they were all pretty conspiratorial.
Okay.
What you don't see is the sons conspiring quite as much amongst themselves, but I take your point. So we go 4?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Qualities of film?
I'd probably say 6.
Okay, I was going to go 5 or 6, so let's go 6. Because we've talked it up a bit, you know.
It's a bit too long. So with the amount of...
You do go round and round and round.
Happening, it keeps happening over and over and over again. And some of the emotional payoff at the end...
Yes.
I'm not really...
There is none, essentially.
Yeah, I'm not really there for it.
Sorry.
I was going to say, some of the acting is touch and go, and John is atrocious.
Yes.
He literally drags the whole film down a point at least.
Yes, he is. Just far too obvious. And also... You have to watch Catherine in that chin thing. Did that not really annoy you?
No.
Do you not think you really must want to take that thing off? Because it sort of came over a chin. Actually, I learned that it is actually a garment that Lady Jane Grey wears one, actually, when she comes on the throne for 9 days. And it's the church hates it. You're not allowed to have it. It's kind of the royal people have it. So it is actually a particular garment. But it must be incredibly uncomfortable. You're not convinced.
I mean, it probably was uncomfortable, but...
It didn't ruin the play for you. It was like the barrel of lime for me.
Yeah, but what you're saying is, you're saying the problem with the lime is that it's inaccurate.
No, the barrel of lime, they should have put the top back on.
Okay,
I suppose.
I guess. Yeah. What I'm saying is, just because it's uncomfortable doesn't mean that she didn't have to wear it.
Yeah, but annoyed me, I couldn't stop watching it.
Okay. But do you not think it adds to making her kind of stand out?
No, it adds to make me thinking, don't like this.
Did you also think about Stardust while you were watching this?
No.
Because Peter O'Toole is the king in Stardust who has to give out his land and his throne to the son that survives.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh?
So he's dying and he gives and he's like, whichever one of you is left at the end gets my land and my crown.
Didn't think about that at all. So but I will in the future. All right, so we've given it a six. Have we? Get six and a four.
Yeah, I'm going to be interested to see if everybody's angered by our response.
I'm going to be interested
if it's a personal favourite of people.
So, and why would we recommend anybody to go and see this movie?
I think it's a really, really interesting portrayal of kind of monarchy and... It's not monarchy.
If you like witty dip dialogue, isn't it? If you, if you like that cunt through
us. A little send-up of history.
Yeah.
It's plausible. So I think everything that happens is totally plausible. Some of it maybe less than others. But it's just a really interesting kind of like what-if study of history.
Yeah.
And a way of reducing characters who are myths and legends to us down to real people.
Yeah.
That we can completely connect with on a modern level, because they act like people do now. It's always worth kind of making that connection and those parallels between modern like Christmas family dramas and
I hope our Christmas isn't going to be like this. You're coming around at some stage. It's not going to be like this, is it?
Everybody's got knives, David.
All right, on that note, we will have the...
It's 2018 and we're crowders. Although I'm technically not, but still.
Well, you know, whatever, almost. Let's have the roundup of the Battle of Algiers with our lovely new jingle.
Wolf and David's roundup. They're the rootinest, tootinest cowboys in the wild, wild west. Wolf and David's roundup.
Okay, so 86% of those of you who'd seen this film loved the Battle of Algiers. Yes, that is 86%. Now, this, of course, is an excellent example of Disraeli's dictum that there are lies, damned lies, and statistics. Because the truth of it was that 74% of you that voted had never seen it at all. And 40% of those were firmly, happily, and even smugly happy that they were never going to watch it either. I suppose we did rather expect this. I mean, an Italian black and white movie with subtitles, it's almost a cliché, really. But look, I and a few others are here to tell you that you're wrong. Really. It's a fascinating film. I really enjoyed being introduced to it. I made the schoolboy error of leaving the allow anyone to add poll options ticked on Facebook, which is always an opportunity for you lot to exercise your creativity. But Sarah added an interesting one, required viewing for generations of first year undergrads. I wanted to know why specifically, but basically I'm in agreement, unless it's to help with student riots, of course. And I think Sarah was referring to building an understanding of colonialism generally, irrespective of the country doing the colonising. Inevitably, that all ended up in a discussion about colonisation, and Alan was required to roll out the image of the hanging of the five kings, the History of England equivalent of the yellow card. But once that was done, James, Justin, Caroline made the points most effectively. Anyway, David commented on the extraordinary grim detachment of most of the perpetrators in the film, but also how every so often emotional realities broke through, such as the poor bloke tortured into disclosing the hiding place of Ali. Catherine mentioned how extraordinary was the BBC interview of Sardi, and it really was. And that brings me, of course, to Hermione, who made the point that the film makes a link with the behaviour of the Gestapo in occupied France, and that it was a massively controversial film in France. He also gave us a new film to watch, Army of Shadows, that's Army of Shadows, made in 1969. So if any of you know that as well, it'd be great to hear your thoughts. Anyway, if you did watch and like the movie, you are in famous or infamous company, since Michael tells us that it was Che Guevara's favourite film, and make of that what you will. Perfect.
Also, we have tried to start an Instagram, History and Technicolor podcast. So you'll see new stuff coming up on there and hopefully some discussion about other films that we maybe don't always get to in the podcast. So if you're on there, you can come along and follow us and post some nice things or nasty things.
All right, thank you. Well, I'm very impressed. I thought you were going to crucify this movie and you didn't, which is great.
Yeah, I assumed when I was watching it that you hated it because you love and revere the characters and this movie kind of like... just reduces them down to nothing.
I just don't like bickering. I felt sorry for Alice the whole time. Anyway, enough. We've talked about it. Okay, thanks everybody for listening, and we will be back in a couple of weeks' time.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Are you not entertained?